What if Plato ran Facebook or Socrates was in charge of Apple? Can you imagine Aristotle running Amazon or General Motors? Today's guest has thought of just that and how these ancient thinkers can help with both the corporate and political world today. And maybe most importantly, how they can help us find shared values in our continuously divisive world. Hello, this is Anya Leonard, founder of Classical Wisdom, a site dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds, and you're listening to Classical Wisdom Speaks. Today we're talking with Tom Morris, one of the world's top public philosophers and pioneering business thinkers. He's a legendary speaker whose electrifying talks re-engage people around their deepest values and reignite their passion for work and life. He's also the author of over 30 books, including If Aristotle Ran General Motors, and most recently, The Everyday Patriot, How to Be a Great American. Quick note before we begin, if you're new to Classical Wisdom, please check out classicalwisdom.substack.com to enjoy our free newsletter and articles. You can also subscribe and help support our mission to promote and preserve the ancient world by showing its continued relevance in the here and now. Now, on to ancient philosophers running modern companies with Tom Morris. So I wanted to start off with your background because you have a lot of philosophical street cred, so to speak, and you've got your PhD from Yale, you taught at University of Notre Dame, and then you kind of had this big shift from going from this world of academia to the corporate world, and you kind of brought the classics to big businesses like AT&T and Merrill Lynch. What was that shift like? Was there a huge difference in how people saw and appreciated or understood philosophy between those two very different worlds?
Yeah, it was a giant shift, as you can imagine. I mean, I was not trained in the history of philosophy myself. I was trained in the analytic tradition, the 20th century analytic tradition. I was kind of a conceptual thinker. You know, I was really good with analysis and argument, getting really crisp and clear on sometimes fuzzy concepts. But then in graduate school, so I started at UNC Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, and then went on to Yale for master's and PhDs. And, you know, in the academic world, it was all about either history or it was about theory. And I learned really quickly that in the corporate world, it was all about practice. You know, now they weren't uninterested in history or theory, but there had to be a payoff. It had to be something that would be helpful in their work, in their aspirations, in their lives. And fortunately for me, I was always kind of a practically minded person anyway. And secondly, given my training in conceptual clarity, well, look at how many concepts there are in the world of organizational and personal success that need clarifying, like, for example, the concept of success itself, right? What is success? What is happiness? What is partnership? What is it to have a purpose? There are all these questions that arise in the business world, and there are no sort of experts in that world who've been trained in those things. So my first talk I was ever asked to give outside a university classroom, it was a group of business people doing a year-long project for young potential leaders in the community's businesses. And they asked me to come and give a talk on ethics, the ethics of decision-making. And I could have said, well, I'm not the ethics guy at Notre Dame. My specialty was philosophy of religion at the time. You're calling the wrong guy. Here's the person you should talk to. But I just said, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. Sure, I'll do it. And then a guy called me a car dealer. He called me and he said, look, all the dealers in the Midwest get together once a year for a big convention, and we have these speakers to talk to us about motivation. And they all say the same thing, you know, set goals, aim high, believe in yourself, you can do it. He said, is there anything deeper than that about human success that the philosophers have addressed over the centuries? And I said, I don't know. Not the kind of stuff I studied at Yale. Let me look into it. And so I was launched into this world that I had no intention of being a part of. I was trained to university life. I thought I'd spend my whole career in a classroom with people, you know, doing philosophy majors and graduate study and that sort of thing. But then all of a sudden I was thrown into this world where people were asking not only very practical questions, but they were asking those questions in a deeper conceptual way than I had suspected I would discover. So there was more of an ease of transition for me as a philosopher than you might think, going from the theoretical and the historical to the practical. No, it wasn't practical in any superficial sense. It was like they've heard all the superficial stuff. Is there anything deeper? Well, what an invitation for a philosopher, right? Yeah, here, I got a lot of deep stuff. Let me bring it to you. So I would just speak on whatever people ask me about. You know, do you want to hear about success? Okay, let me look into that. Do you want to hear? And so I would dig into, you know, Cicero or Seneca or Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius, or I would go to Aristotle, or I would look at Xenophon, and I would sort of isolate some principles that might be of use in the current time, and I would give a talk, and people would give a standing ovation to the great philosophers. I mean, people were yelling and stomping their feet and clapping and hooting and hollering like they were at a rock concert. I mean, and I'm talking about groups of up to 5 or 10,000 people. And wow. So when you were a philosopher who've been accustomed to being around a seminar table contemplating, you know, the perplexities of modal metaphysics, and all of a sudden you're in front of 5,000 people in Las Vegas and they're treating it like it's a Bruce Springsteen concert or something, you think, wow, people have more of an interest in philosophy than we give them credit for. So it's been an amazing experience.
That sounds like quite the journey. You know, I love that, though. I think, you know, one of the missions that we have at Classical Wisdom is bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds and showing the practicality and the applicability of these ancient thinkers. And so I love that sometimes I think the academic world, the system of it, kind of encourages people to become more and more niche because of the way the doctorates are set up and everything. And so as a result, it becomes less relatable to the general public. I mean, I've had some fascinating podcast, but they get really niche sometimes. You know, it's like the way that they buried the dead in wartime and the archaic versus the classical periods. I mean, it was really interesting, but there's a, like, that's kind of hard to go to the supermarket and say, you know, this is gonna help you pick out your beans. Like,
yeah, right.
It's kind of the transition sometimes, though, by taking a step into a different field kind of gives you that sort of multidisciplinary aspect, but it lets you see the sort of the forest from the trees and kind of get the bigger picture of the overall arching ideas that you can get in philosophy, or the really profound ones that, I mean, can kind of sometimes get lost in more modern philosophy. I think get kind of lost in the jargon or the terminology to put people off.
Absolutely. And one of the things I was most surprised by, not just the sheer enthusiasm with which audiences greeted these talks I started giving, but the sheer intelligence of so many people in corporate life, just and many of whom may have been philosophy majors or may have taken 4 or 5 courses in philosophy or in classics. I mean, a lot of people who go into the corporate world, they've indulged their own interests before they got an MBA and became an accountant or a comptroller or something in a big business. And so I was ennobling these folks in their lives to bring them wisdom from the greatest thinkers who've ever lived. And it's almost like I was respecting them at a level they weren't accustomed to being addressed at. And so they really responded. And often the people at the top levels of these organizations, they would appreciate what I was bringing them, but they would worry about whether the frontline people could understand the same concepts. And one time I went to, two things about that. I was given a talk for a company in America that rents trucks. And I was in front of their 2,500 dealers. I was backstage right before my talk. And the president of the company came up to me and he said, you know, I got to warn you, these aren't people who know who Plato and Aristotle are. They own a mom and pop grocery store or convenience store. They rent a couple of trucks out back every now and then. They're here for an annual convention. So you may have to tone down some of the philosophy. And, you know, there's a sea of 2,500 people. And there I am standing backstage and this guy's telling me they're not going to understand the people you're going to talk about today. And I'm thinking, well, why did you hire me then? But I said, don't worry. What I talk about is universal. And I was hoping he believed it because I hardly believed it being told what I had just been told. But I walked out on stage. I didn't change a thing about the talk I had planned to give. And he told me later, he said, that's the first standing ovation any speaker has ever gotten from this audience. And I said, that's the universality of ancient wisdom. Another company, International Paper, I gave a talk to their top 250 people. Then they said, we're going to send you to all our factories around the U.S. and we're going to shut down the factory for that hour or two, and we're going to bring everybody together. We want you to give your talk about success. I said, okay. So once, I don't know if it was Alabama, it was a hot part of the South. It was a summertime. It was in a big field outside the factory. It was 98 degrees, you know, in the shade. And they start bringing the people, the guys from the loading dock, the guys from the mill equipment who run the equipment. And some of the guys looked like they'd just gotten out of prison the day before, right? They were just scowling at me like, who is this guy? Why do we have to sit out here in the heat? You know? And then after my talk, and I'm mentioning Plato and Aristotle and Seneca and William James, and some of the toughest looking guys come rushing up to me and hug me. And one of the guys picked me up off the ground and said, we all needed to hear this today. And I'm thinking, okay, that's the universality of philosophy.
Oh, I think that's just beautiful. I mean, I genuinely am getting like tears in my eyes because I think, you know, we live in a world right now where we're fed so much noise, you know, on social media and news. And there's this like constant just barrage of information. And it's kind of hard to sift what's real, what's not. And a lot of times it's just trying to grab headlines and be clickbait and get people to scroll further. And I think there's a real desire, genuinely, for all society to feel the meaningful. And I think what's one of the beautiful things about the ancient history and philosophy is that anyone can take part in it. It's part of a great conversation that anyone from all over the world can take part in. And, you know, I usually live abroad in various random countries like Argentina. And, you know, the classics are beloved here. Every bus stop, newspaper stand has at least two classical works there, and sometimes a version for kids you're going to go pick up your newspaper, you can buy a copy of Plato, you know, every single stand.
That's amazing.
So, and you know, I find this kind of experience all over that there is, like you said, this universality in it.
There is, if you give people the opportunity to think about things that matter. I mean, the first person who ever invited me to give that very first talk off campus, she lived in my neighborhood, and she came to my house one day and said, hey, we've heard how popular your classes are at Notre Dame. She said, would you come to the Chamber of Commerce? We serve all the small businesses in the area and give us a talk. She said, because here's the problem. She said, when I was in college, we used to sit up late at night and talk about things that really matter. Love and friendship and meaning and purpose and life and death. And she said, now I'm 45 years old. When I get together with my friends, all we talk about is who's Notre Dame playing in the football game this weekend? What's on sale at the mall? What are the kids doing? She said, we're awash in trivialities. We never think about and talk about the important things anymore. Could you come give us an excuse to do that? I mean, wow, what an invitation, right? I said, you know, it's been recognized since the time of Socrates that we tend to drift into thinking and talking the most about things that matter the least and the least about the things that matter the most. We need to turn that around. So that's why I gave that first talk. I don't think anybody offered to pay me anything. In fact, the first 2 years, I was giving talks for community groups and business groups. I didn't think speakers got paid. I was just doing it for free, just to build bridges between the world I'd lived in, the world of ideas, and the world of action and commerce that these folks lived in. And just to see the excitement about it was a reward unto itself, you know. You're absolutely right. We have this elitist attitude about philosophy, about the humanities, about the classics. But people crave this. People of all walks of life, if we just give them a chance, they really come alive when hearing these things.
So I'd love to get into some of the guts of some of your points. And, you know, you've written several great books, one of which is called If Aristotle Ran General Motors, which is just a great name and immediately captures the attention. But what would you say some of the ideas that have been the most applicable or most appreciated by your audience? Some like the ideas of success from the ancient world, or some of those tidbits that you find has been the most rewarding for your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Of all the talks I give, all the topics I speak on, the topic of true success, now called subtitled The Art of Achievement in Times of Change, that's been the number one talk I've been asked to give over the years. I've lost track, lost count. I've given over 1,200 talks, and maybe up to 1,400 at this point. But of those, probably at least half are that topic. And when I went back to look at success in the ancient world, first of all, I try to give people a greater understanding of the concept of success. It's not intrinsically about money or power or fame or status. It's about, I used to tell my students, my undergraduates, I call it the 3D approach to success. It's about discovering your talents, developing those talents, and deploying them into the world for the good of others as well as yourself. It's about becoming your best and doing your best for other people and making your positive impact on the world. And once we separated it from those sometime occasional accompaniments like money, fame, power, and all the rest, we can concentrate on what really matters. So I came up after just surveying lots of ancient, medieval, Renaissance, and modern literature. I saw deep down beneath very different traditions. So you can get some of these things from the Tao Te Ching, from the Analects of Confucius, from various Hindu sources, as well as from the Greek and Roman classics. I came up with a framework of seven things, seven tools for success. I call them the seven C's of success in English. We need a clear conception of what we want to see happen as a result of our efforts in any opportunity, any challenge. We need to have our own clear conception of what it is we want to attain. Number two, we need a strong confidence that we can attain the goal. And number three, we need to focus concentration on what it's going to take. It's not enough to have a clear goal and dream big and be confident. You got to break it down, okay? Divide and conquer. What if I want to be a certain place 6 months from now, where do I need to be 3 months from now, a month from now, a week from now? What can I do today? We need a stubborn consistency in pursuing the vision. So I can't act one way today and another way tomorrow and act contrary to my own intentions and expect it to go well. Consistency understood properly, not as a blind repetitive behavior, but as harmony with our highest goals and deepest values, whatever the circumstances might be, is a real force multiplier. An emotional commitment to the importance of what we're doing, the passions, the heart, a good character to guide us and keep us on a proper course. A lot of Aristotle packed into that. A capacity to enjoy the process along the way. Too many people gut it out. They just feel like they've just got to be miserable to attain the success they want in life. They're never the people who get it. It's the people who love what they're doing. And we all have hard days. But if I can help people to cultivate a capacity to enjoy whatever can be enjoyed, or help do something else where you can find enjoyment, then you flourish, then you blossom. And the whole idea of eudaimonia, or of well-being, or of human flourishing, of happiness defined not as giddiness or just a pleasant feeling, but as a kind of being and doing in the world, if people get this deeper sense, then it just sort of, it unleashes them, it liberates them, almost like Epictetus, who said, you know, I was a slave, but so are you. We're all enslaved to something. There are too many people enslaved to false conceptions of success. If I can liberate them from those chains and then give them practical guidance from the great philosophers, look, this is not me making it up. This is just me bringing you what great people have said before me. Then that's what people get so excited about. So that became a book called True Success, my first non-academic book after 10 or 11 University Press books, Oxford and Cornell and Notre Dame Press. True Success became a really best-selling book, launched a lot of talks. And then I realized there's something more to success than just goal setting and goal attainment. That's all we talk about in our culture right now. But there's a relationship side of success that nobody's talking about. So that research became the book If Aristotle Ran General Motors. The goal setting side, the teleology, the relationship building side, the sociology, you might call it. Let's put these things together. And so that became my first legitimate big national bestseller. And CEOs would tell me they have it on their in their office, on the shelf. They've had it for 20 years, for 30 years. When they saw it in a bookstore, if Aristotle ran General Motors, they said, okay, I got to get this book. And it wasn't even my title. I had a boring title, Reinventing Corporate Spirit. But I gave a draft of the book to a friend who was a hospital president. And he said, I love this book. I love everything about this book, except the title is really boring. And I said, well, reinventing was a thing in the 90s. Everybody wanted to reinvent their organization. So I said, well, why don't we reinvent the corporate spirit, you know? And he said, yeah, I get it, but it's a bad title. Maybe something like If Aristotle Ran General Motors. I mean, yeah, I said, maybe something exactly like that. So I can't even take credit for probably my most famous title.
Well, it's good that you're honest about it and open-minded to take suggestions wherever they may be. Yeah, you know, it's funny that you're saying, not funny, but it's interesting that you're saying about these different elements, and you know, there's a bit of Aristotle here, and a, you know, obviously a bit of Stoicism, and yep. You know, I noticed that when you talk about finding the joy sometimes in it, like that's a bit Epicurus to me.
Oh yeah,
the idea like of appreciating the moment and present, and it's interesting because you know I've been working a bit of on a theory for a while, a concept of my own about the art of cherry picking, because we want to find these gems and these points of universality within these ancient philosophers and take the points of it that are applicable in our modern lives. So do you have a process in which you find something that is universal or useful to people now versus, you know, like I always say, like there's so much greatness in Stoicism that if you get caught up on the cold showers, you might miss out on the rest of it, you know?
The cold showers and the sleeping on the floor and the eating bread maybe every other day if you eat anything at all. And, you know, what about all this metaphysics about strict determinism, and what about the Jupiter, and what about but it's funny. It's good for you with the project and the title, because there is this crazy prejudice in the academic world against the thing we all naturally do, the cherry picking, right? Why not? Here's my image for myself as a philosopher. Now, I live at the beach, so it's a strange image to have, but I imagine myself in the mountains of North Carolina, one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world, where people often go to pan for gold. And they stand all day in a cold mountain stream with a pan, and their pan most of the day is filled with mud. Every now and then, they see a gold sparkle, and they pluck it out. That's their gold nugget they found that day. As a philosopher, I may read a 700-page book and pluck out one gold nugget from that book. I stand in the cold stream all day long. My pan is full of mud much of the day. Other people don't have the time to do that. I do. I enjoy doing it, and I enjoy finding those nuggets, which I pluck out, polish up, and give to people in my talks and books. It's cherry picking, same metaphor, right? It's what we have to do in a different place and time with different challenges. Yes, human nature has always been the same, but our environment is always changing, as Heraclitus saw, right? So what we have to do is we have to find what in Plato, what in Aristotle, what in these various thinkers comes alive for us now. So I read it as a person who's living when I'm living at the point of history, and I see what jumps out at me. And so I pull these over to one side, and then I put them to the test in my own life. I will never speak or write about something I haven't tried out myself, because I want to, even though it sounds great, oh, this is surely going to help me. Well, will it or not? And so I'll try it in my own life. If it works, I'll tell some friends. They can try it in their lives, or I'll give some small talks to small groups of people. And if that still seems to work, if they resonate, we just take it more broadly, more broadly. I may give a talk 100 times before I think, you know, this should be a book. It should be put in a permanent form. So I'm always trying out. It's like the laboratory of life. I'm always, so that the cherry picking, we actually get the best cherries for people, and we give them to these things in a form they can use right now. That's just a wonderful feeling.
Yes, I think it's It's also a reaction in a way to sort of, I think, a tendency that's happening now to say that if the historical person didn't live to our modern standards, then we should just discard them completely. And I think, one, you're not going to find any human being that is perfect in history or alive today. Two, the standards which we think are so great now, probably in 100, 1,000 years from now, we're going to look back and think we didn't even have great standards. It's almost a hubris to think that we are at the peak of what we can hold ancient people to. But three, it's just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, like,
absolutely right.
Just because Newton.
Just
because Newton, you know, believed in alchemy doesn't mean his discoveries in gravity aren't worthwhile.
You know, and we have so much prejudice nowadays against anybody who got anything wrong. And I've never come across a philosopher, never, who got everything right. I mean, they don't have to be right to be helpful. They have to be interesting to be helpful. They have to get some things, go more deeply on some things than we already have in our own lives, or else we've got nothing to learn. But yet when we discover these things, well, are we supposed to throw them out just because they got something else very wrong? I mean, I get it. I get why people are like that. I had a discussion just the other night. I had three book groups, three nights in a row on my latest book, The Everyday Patriot, How to Be a Great American Now. And we were talking about the values of the founders of the United States of America. And some guy got really mad about attributing any positive values to the founders, because look, they stole the land from the Native Americans. They enslaved Africans. They had no respect for women. And I was listening to this guy, real tirade, you know, and I said, well, look, I mean, first of all, no respect for women. Read the letters between Abigail Adams and her husband, John, who was in Philadelphia for the Declaration of Independence. She gave him wisdom all the time, and he listened to her, and she made him change his mind about things. So it wasn't the case that none of the men respected any of the women. That's kind of an extreme position. And secondly, I said, look, the values I ascribe to the founders, there are two ways to think of values. One's an absolutist way. Either you completely have this value and live it in every way in your life, or you don't have that value at all. Not many of us have many values if we approach values in an absolutist way. You can approach values in an aspirational way, that you're trying to live, you aspire to live this value, you're doing your best, and you're hoping to do better in the future. I said, when I ascribe values to the founders of America, I'm ascribing these values mostly in an aspirational way. They live these things very imperfectly, but they were very imperfectly living some of the right values. And we need to thank them for bringing these values to our attention, while sort of forgiving them for getting so much of it wrong in their own time, because they were people of their time. As you mentioned, Anya, C.S. Lewis once said, every age has its own assumptions that it just doesn't question. And they're like the air we breathe. We're hardly even aware that we have them. The only way we become aware is reading books written in other times where the assumptions were different. He says the books of the future are not yet available, so we should all read the books of the past, just to give us a sense of this contrast, not just with, okay, let's find out how much better we are than the Romans were with respect to, you know, slavery, with respect to gender, with respect to, wait, let's see if there's something they got right that maybe we're not getting right. Absolutely. I completely agree.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, as a society, we're willing to separate the art from the artist, or the music from the musician, but not the thinker from the thoughts. It's kind of a lack of consistency in that regard. But
that's a very good point.
I want to get, you mentioned your book, and that was, I really want to get into that as well, because you kind of, you've had another huge shift, I feel like. Maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've moved now from the corporate to the political. This idea of discussing what makes a good patriot and returning to values.
Completely unexpected, just like the transition in the corporate world was completely unexpected. And here's the book. It's sitting right beside me, The Everyday Patriot. It's a little book, but it's having this big impact with people. And a friend of mine, a guy I've known for 31 years now, he called me years ago and said, hey, I just bought a copy of the Declaration of Independence for $8 million. He actually spent $8.2 million, I think it was. I said,
Wow.
Really? You overpaid. I got a copy at the local bookstore for $4.95. He said, well, a guy bought a painting at a yard sale in Philadelphia just to get the frame to use for something he had at home and had a bad frame. He needed a better frame. So he wanted to take out the picture, didn't like the picture. He got home, he started taking it apart. Something was folded up behind this bad picture. It was an original printing of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776. 200 Whoa. Copies were printed that night in secret to be distributed to the colonies and read aloud in public places so people would know what was going on. Wow. 23 of those were known to have to still exist, not to have been destroyed. And this was number 24, if I remember correctly. And so the guy who bought it for $4 auctioned it off, and he got $8.2 million for it. And my friend said, I bought it to send it around the country so people could read and see our national birth certificate and the values that our nation is supposed to stand for. Would you come up with a speech that you could give in connection with the tour of the Declaration and about our founding values? And I said, oh, okay. And so he calls me 2 weeks later and said, I had to turn this over to a team of people. He's a famous producer in Hollywood, TV and film producer. He said, and then word leaked out in Hollywood. Now every Oscar winner wants to travel with the Declaration and be the person who gives the speech. And my team says, no, it was Norman Lear. He said, Norman, who's going to draw the crowd? Your friend, the philosopher in Wilmington, North Carolina, or the Oscar winners of our day? He said, all right. I said, well, why don't we turn it into a book? He said, that's a good idea. So that was the origin of the book. Not my idea at all. But when I went back and read the Declaration of Independence and other early American documents and saw how much these founders of America relied on British philosophers and German philosophers and Roman and Greek philosophers, I thought, okay, I'm going to go back and see how Aristotle, how politics as about how best to live well together, not as a game, not as a blood sport, but politics as about human flourishing, right? And you read Aristotle's book, The Politics, and I extracted a formula: people in partnership for a shared purpose, people plural in partnership, a certain kind of relationship for a shared purpose, guided with a value-laden sense of what they wanted to make happen. And so I wrote this little book trying to avoid all the political divisions of our day so that no political faction would say, oh, he's one of them. I'm not going to listen to this book. I'm not going to read this book. And apparently it succeeded, because in these book groups from all over the people all over the country, people on opposite ends of the political spectrum are saying, oh, this is interesting. We need to think more about this. We need to talk more about this. And my favorite email I got about this book was a few months ago, a young guy, very, very philosophical, 19-year-old in Bucharest, Romania. He said, I just read your book, The Everyday Patriot, and now I want to be a better Romanian. And I said, okay, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to see from this.
Well, you've preempted one of my later questions, but before we get to that, I would like to kind of get into some of these, what are some of these shared values and concepts that you say, you know, makes America or maybe any nation a great nation. And I do, but just to say quickly, I love that you've taken a nonpartisan approach at it. And I think that's so important, because I see the sort of divisiveness that's happening, the polarization, especially when you're like on the outside looking in, and it's you know, it's terrifying, and it leads to disaster, as history will attest to. So I think if the goal of pointing out and demonstrating shared values is not only like a noble mission, but probably one of the few things we can do to bring back a nation that's sort of divided.
That's right, because even people who are on opposite ends of the political spectrum, if they meet each other because they're both volunteering at a homeless shelter, a food pantry, a soup kitchen, and get to know each other as people before issues of politics ever come up, then they've established a relationship. I mean, I love this passage in the Iliad. I wish I could quote, you know, book and verse, but where these two guys are getting ready to fight, and one of them says, wait a minute, I've watched you today. You're amazing. You know, I got to know who you are. And the guy says, what do you mean who I am? I'm the guy who's getting ready to kill you or something like that. And he said, well, yeah, probably, but you got to tell me who you are. And after a little give and take of this guy being puzzled by why he's being, look, we're in the middle of a battle, you know? And he said, no, please. And the guy says, all right, my father was so-and-so from such-and-such, and my grandfather was so-and-so from, wait, whoa, whoa, your grandfather was who? Wait, my grandfather and your grandfather were friends. What? Yeah, your grandfather provided amazing hospitality for my grandfather, and they got to be really close. We can't fight each other. And the guy says, I guess you're right. We can't fight each other. And so they trade armor so their friends will know that there's a special pact, you know? And it's like in the bloodiest, one of the bloodiest stories ever written, the Iliad, you know, here's this little bit of peace where two guys don't label each other the enemy to be killed, but find that they have something in common that means more than any of that. And they become close. And I tell people that all the time. I say, look, if you can find things you agree on, forget the things you disagree on. Maybe 80% of the things you disagree on, find that 20% that you hold in common. You love your family. You wish your neighborhood was safer. You wish that the poor in your town have more resources. Get together with other people over things you share in common. And then all of a sudden you'll begin to care a little bit less about the things you differ on. And you'll be able to expand those circle of agreements in ways that might even really surprise you.
I think that's beautifully said. And it's, you know, it's, I think people forget how quick we are to see differences. And I always think that narcissism of small differences is a perfect example. And some of the bloodiest wars have been fought between two groups of people that are, like, from an outside perspective, almost identical. You know, they might have one difference in their policy and their religion, or one, you know, something really minuscule. And it's almost like the smaller the difference, the more people focus and concentrate and obsess about that difference when they're not paying attention to, as you just beautifully said, all the things that they share in common and those shared values.
Well, you know, I'm just shopping around a book to publishers now, about why smart and talented people do so many stupid and self-destructive things. And this very problem you bring up, they can focus on something really tiny and blow it up into something really big and end up starting physical wars that are the worst things that human beings have ever experienced. And we should have learned by now, they never accomplish anything good. They just postpone problems and create other problems. My book is based on Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein, which I take to be one of the greatest cautionary tales in history. And she wrote a second book. Well, she wrote a number of books, but one that nobody knows about was published a few years later in 1826. And its subject was, it's a novel about a pandemic in the 21st century that kills everybody. And it's called The Last Man because it's narrated by the last man alive. But when you read this book about a pandemic, talk about a prescient topic. When you read this book, it's not so much about epidemiology as it is about the very same character traits she saw in Victor Frankenstein, her protagonist, in her earlier book, because she saw him in her boyfriend, Percy Shelley, and in his best friend, Lord Byron. And in the people who came to her house, her mother was an early feminist philosopher, Mary Wollstonecraft. Her dad was a well-known philosopher. All kinds of famous people would come to their house to have dinner and have conversations. And she saw the dark side of their success and their fame. And so she writes this book about a smart and talented man, Victor Frankenstein, who has this audacious goal and who does those seven things I ticked off. He does most of those things to attain his goal, by which he unleashes into the world a monster he can't control. Now, what a metaphor that is for so much that goes on in human life in our time and throughout history. So I call my book The Frankenstein Factor, Monster Success and Massive Failure, how our very successes can turn into terrible failures if we have the wrong motives, means, and methods. So Mary's stories gave me a new framework for analyzing who never to hire, who never to promote, who never to invest in, who never to vote for, and most of all, who never to be. And if we can learn more about how to avoid this, maybe we'll have a better world.
You know, I do a lot of work with various Stoic groups, including Modern Stoics and the Aurelius Foundation, as you well know, because that's how I met you through some of these joint ventures. And, you know, it's really interesting. I was talking to Justin Steed, who runs the Aurelius Foundation, and he also is the CEO of a $1 billion company in London. And I was talking to him about, you know, Stoicism, how it's been so helpful and powerful to people today, and, you know, with giving them tactics and methods and perspectives to get through really difficult times, and how it's, you know, just absolutely instrumental for all these people. And Justin said to me, you know, Stoicism, it helps people when they're having a hard time, but actually I find that it's even more helpful for when people are really successful. you know, it kind of blew my mind when he said that. But then I was thinking back through history, and you think of all the various Roman emperors and how power and fame and success can change people. And once they have that power and that money and that success, once they're changed, then the damage that they can wreck and havoc. But, you know, the rare examples of the potential philosopher kings or queens, that is even has a much outsized response when those individuals who are successful can be still good people.
Right. If we could help them handle their success better, if we could help them handle their power better, because there's actually a lot of neurobiological research that having power, or more accurately, believing that you have power, because a person doesn't actually have to have it, but if they think they have power, it actually degrades various brain function, almost to be the equivalent of temporary brain damage, where people are not as empathetic, they're not as good at risk management, they're not as good at projecting the consequences of their behavior long term. And it's almost like what Seneca says, and other Stoics say it as well, but I'm reading Seneca these days, so I'm fresh on him, how with his big exercise on anger, he says, you've got to cut it off at the start, because once it gets momentum, it's like a person who's running really fast and is not going to be able to stop instantly, right? So if you let the successful indulge the wrong behaviors for too long, it's going to be really hard to call them back. But if you can help them cut it off with the right principles, with the right recognitions and understandings early on, they spot what's going on in their own lives, they can pull back then. They still have the power to do that. So that he's right. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that too. I need to talk to him, because I was just asked by the, you know, we have in the U.S. and it's around the world too, but it's really well known in the U.S. the Dummies series of books, Big Yellow Books. I was asked years ago in the 90s if I would do philosophy for dummies. They had asked the Metropolitan Museum curator, Metropolitan Museum of Art, Thomas Hoving, if he would do the book Art for Dummies. And then they asked me if I would do philosophy for dummies. I said, but you guys do books on practical things, right? Like gardening and car repair and computer software. And they said, oh yeah, that's how we built the series. But now we want to launch into lifetime learning. We want to do the humanities and the arts and the sciences. And we want you two guys to do the first two books. I said, oh, that would be awesome. So I did a book called Philosophy for Dummies. Well, just a week ago, they said, we need you to do a new book. Because a year ago, I had done a new edition. And I said, on what? And they said, Stoicism. We want you to do the book Stoicism for Dummies. She said, we're watching this worldwide interest, this wave of interest across our culture in this country and in other countries as well. Has a philosophy ever been that popular in the modern world? And I said, well, you know, existentialism had a day in the 40s and 50s among the beatniks and the beat generation poets and stuff. And Buddhism, philosophy of Buddhism had a thing in the 60s and 70s, the Beatles and the Maharishi and the Hindu and Buddhist stuff. I said, but yeah, Stoicism just seemed to. I did a little book called The Stoic Art of Living in the late 90s. It was published in 2004 by a small press before anybody cared, before anybody was interested in this. And so to see it just blossom into this huge interest across business, the military, sports, entertainment, it's amazing. So you and I should take advantage. So I ended up saying, well, I'll do it if I can recruit one of my former graduate students who is a really good historian. because I'm a conceptual guy and he's a really good historian and we'll do it together. So they want us to write it between now and September. That's wow, like an insane schedule for a 300-page book, right? And okay, and they want us to not just say what all the other books are so well saying, you know, all the books that are out on Stoicism now. It's like, really, we need another book? Well, we better write it in such a way that it takes us to a new level in our understanding of Stoicism. And so that's our commitment. We're going to do some new stuff. And it's because I agree with what your friend said. It's needed at every level. And the sooner the better.
It's funny. I talk a lot with A.A. Long, Tony, he's one of the, I'm almost like the father of modern Stoicism almost. And yeah, he just gets such a chuckle every time, you know, he's like, I just never would have thought.
Yeah, like, I mean,
I was writing about this stuff in the 60s and it was like so niche. He still seems, he just every time seems to be so, and every time I speak to him, you know, every year or so, it's gone even bigger and bigger.
He must feel like it's crazy time, because it's almost as if, go back into the 80s when I was doing modal metaphysics, possibility and necessity and all that. And suppose people came to me and said, there are 4 books on the New York Times bestseller list on modal metaphysics. I would have said, wait, what? What alternate reality do I live in all of a sudden? Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to process, but you know, we need to take advantage of this, right? Well, make hay while the sun shines. You know, we need to make a difference in people's lives now that they're interested in things that matter.
I say Marcus Aurelius is my gateway drug. Stoicism is a point of entry to the world of philosophy. And I'm just like, yes, yes, come in for the Stoics, stay for the Epicurus, yeah. Mm-hmm. Have a look around skepticism. You know, it's as I was saying, there's so much knowledge and gems in these ancient philosophies that I think can benefit people. So I'm happy, as you say, that people are kind of getting into it.
And not every book has to get it right. Not every proponent. There's so many excited evangelists out there who are, like you said earlier, they're pumping up the thing that they really hit them, the cold showers or the sleeping on the floor or whatever it is. Okay, and why was that? Let's go a little deeper. Let's connect it up with some other things. So I'll start anywhere with anybody who has an enthusiasm about the ancient Stoics. Let's start with what tickles your fancy. Let's start with what drew your attention, and you'll be amazed where we'll end up.
Now, can I ask, do you think some of these Stoic values are part of these sort of combined values that can help bridge the divide in America?
Oh, absolutely. I thought I invented this myself, and I was surprised to find out, no, I'm a kind of a latecomer on this idea. This was years ago when nobody knew who the Stoics were, and especially nobody knew who Heracles was. I mean, okay, Marcus Aurelius, some people knew about Marcus Aurelius. But so I write The Everyday Patriot, and I have a few images in there, like the image that patriotism is not adversarial. It's not xenophobic. It's not militaristic. It's not us against somebody else. Patriotism at its best is about growing your garden, cultivating your garden to be the best it can possibly be for the good of others as well as yourself, and offering the bounty to other people. And I developed this principle of what I call concentric circles. Imagine, I was thinking about Aristotle and teleology. I was thinking about the archery, the target, the archery target, the bands, the concentric circles, the bands from the bullseye out. And I thought, well, imagine the inner circle as your own heart and mind. You got to get your own heart and mind in good shape if you want to get your next circle out in good shape, which is your household, right? Your family. If you have a healthy heart and mind, maybe you can build a healthy family. And then the next circle out is your neighborhood. If you bring to your neighborhood a healthy person, a healthy family, then you can help cultivate a better, healthier neighborhood. And likewise with your town, your state, your nation, your world. So come to find out that Heracles had used this same imagery And he and I develop it in a little bit different way. But here's this ancient Stoic that nobody knew about. And he's talking about concentric circles. And he's talking about, he's plugging into this idea about being a citizen of the world. And my attitude about the circles is that each circle contributes to the next one out. And each outward circle needs to support those inner circles that contribute to it. So there's a mutual care and contribution going on. So that you see that politics in the end is not about ideology so much as it is about health, personal health, community health, national health, global health. How can we build healthier societies? And when you switch you're not going to agree on everything, even about that. But at least you have a positive principle in mind to use to move forward.
Now, I think this is something that a lot of people worry and fear, is that there are these greater political structures and systems and powerful people that are operating very much beyond the control of the individual, and that you know, one of the elements of Stoicism sometimes is to realize what's in our control and what's out of our control. So when trying to take on this huge project of finding shared values, of trying to bridge this society, is it something that the individual can accomplish, or does it need to also be happening at top levels, at ideological levels or structures?
Yeah,
I mean, is it,
yeah.
I mean, it's, how can we solve this?
I see it has to go on in both ways. I mean, because too much of modern politics has become a spectator sport. People feel disempowered in their own lives to make a difference. So they come together in these huge crowds, these huge mobs to follow a charismatic leader. And I think of the Pied Piper story, right? They're following these leaders often into the wrong directions and to their own detriment. And what we need to do is to not view politics anymore as gamesmanship or as a sport or as a spectator sport. We need to reimagine politics as all about healthy flourishing at every level of our lives. And I have this concept in the book, The Everyday Patriot, a concept of voting every day. I said, you know, vote when there is an election. But if you look at the word election itself, what does that mean? It's to choose. The etymology of electing is just choosing. Well, every day we make choices. Like when I go on my daily walk in my neighborhood, if I see a piece of trash, I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to do something about it, not just walk past it. These little choices, these little elections, these little votes we cast every day with our time, our attention, our energy can add up. If we take back politics as part of our own condition, our own human condition, rather than as something we watch from afar, we can begin to make a difference. Also, we need to elect people who have the same attitude. And once we do, they will give us this additional inspiration. They will provide additional resources so that we won't be fighting an uphill battle all the time. And that's the way it's a yin and yang. It's kind of a both and situation. The dynamic has to flow in both directions. But once we get it going, then we can see a difference, I think. And I'm a firm believer in the pendulum model for human experience. There are these pendulums that swing from one extreme to the other, right? And Aristotle kind of captured that in his view of the virtues, right? For every virtue, there's two extremes, two vices. And often in people's lives, the pendulum swings from one to the other. A guy who used to be cowardly now becomes foolhardy in reaction against that, or vice versa. No, there's this middle state that's amazing. And so we see society get almost out of control. The pendulum has swung to one extreme. Well, I become an optimist because I think we're closer to the return swing. And let's try to capture people as that happens and give them that healthy sense of the middle ground as the ground to occupy and grow their garden in. That can make all the difference in the world.
I've been talking a lot about this topic with Massimo Pigliucci, and he wrote a book called The Quest for Character. And, you know, he was saying something very similar, that we're in a very negative cycle right now where we've become cynical. And so we aren't participating. And I think your point is perfectly said, that we need to be active and thoughtful about it again if we want to be the change that we need. And I think your secondary point is absolutely essential, that as the pendulum swings, if we can just, you know, stop for a moment, have a look around, get in the middle space.
Absolutely right. You know, because we have people spokespeople on both ends of almost every spectrum. But we don't have enough people calling us to the middle ground. That's what we need. And I think we can make a surprising difference if we speak out for the wisdom and virtue middle ground, because most people have a visceral sense that there's something wrong about the extremes, even if they're participating in one of the extremes. They're conflicted about it to some extent. And if you can point out a more golden path, right, then they're going to be attracted. So that's what I try to do in the book, Everyday Patriot. And it's funny because you ask about what kind of difference it signaled, because I was doing the corporate and now it's the political. And what's next is almost what I've been doing in both those contexts already, the personal. True success was almost as much about personal success as it was about organizational institutional success. In fact, probably even more so, because organizational success I see is arising out of the right kind of personal success. And so this political book, somebody read it recently and said, wait a minute, this inner circle principle is needed in the corporate world too, because there are companies in which different divisions of the same company are fighting each other. They need to understand each other as part of a common, you know, shared purpose. And these circles, I can use that in the corporate world. So it's all connected. The Frankenstein factor is going to relate to politics as well as corporate life, right? And it's going to be a cautionary tale about people, for people in their personal lives. A book I had come out right before the pandemic, people said to me, are you some kind of a genius? You know exactly the book we need to, it's the book. I have it right here on my desk. It's Plato's Lemonade Stand, Stirring Change into Something Great. There's an old saying in the south of the U.S. where I grew up, it's when life hands you lemons, make lemonade. And people in other countries tell me they've heard that too. We've talked about resilience for a long time. When something bad happens, bounce back. We've talked about grit now for 10 years. In tough times, soldier on, you know, be persistent, be determined. But this whole image of when life hands you lemons, something sour, something bitter, make lemonade, something sweet and delightful, that goes beyond resilience. It goes beyond grit. It's a transformational attitude about difficulty to delight. And the reason the book came out when it did, right before the biggest load of lemons anybody had ever experienced with COVID, is that it took me 15 years to write it. It had 6 different titles. It got rejected 44 times. So finally, by the time all that was done, it was 2 months before the pandemic hit. So no, I'm not a genius at all, but I draw on the ideas of people who are.
Now, can I just say, just on a very silly side note, that I don't know if you're familiar with the beaches in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, but they have these little stands, like numbers along the whole beach. And each little stand is, it looks like a little lemonade stand, but you get coconut water, really? Or mojitos, or caipirinhas, maybe a plate of fried shrimp. And there's one that's, I think, in Copacabana. And it's Socrates's. It's called Socrates, and it looks just like that. But it says Socrates on the beach. I've taken a photo of it. I will send it to you because it's.
Well, that's great, because my daughter Sarah Morris was the cover designer of this book, and when she showed it to me, she said, "Okay, before I show it to you, don't say no right away." And she showed it to me. And I said yes right away because I thought, you know, because it's so serious. You know, I'm using Plato as an inspiration. I mean, here's a guy who's idol, whose mentor, whose ideal about everything good is poisoned by popular demand, right? And what does he do? Does he say, "Okay, no more philosophy for me"? If that's the way people are going to be about it. No, he reinvents philosophy in a lot of ways. And he turns this difficulty into delight. So he's kind of my guiding inspiration, but I draw deeply on the Stoics. I draw deeply on all the classic sources and try to help people understand, because when I grew up hearing that, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade, nobody ever said how. And so I thought, I wonder if the philosophers said how, and turns out they did.
Can I ask one final question, because you've been so generous with your time, and I would just love to know, you've sort of drawn on so many different philosophers, and we've talked about like the popularity of Stoicism. Is there an ancient source that you think is just a well of wisdom that people haven't realized or appreciated yet?
Oh, yeah, a lot, I think. Absolutely. I mean, it was like, before I discovered Blaise Pascal, the 17th century philosopher and mathematician. I hadn't heard anybody talk about Pascal. Before I read the Stoics, I was teaching a seminar at Notre Dame on Pascal for elderly people. It was called Elder Hostel. It was for people retired, often in their 70s and 80s, would come to the university for a month and take courses. Maybe my course they'd take for a week. And after this introductory thing on Blaise Pascal, where I thought, you know, it was such a great introduction I was giving, and a guy, an old guy, I'm almost 100 years old, comes up to me afterwards and said, "Seneca said it all." And I thought, who is Seneca? Because they didn't teach Seneca, right? So, yeah, I think there are a lot of resources. In fact, I'm just finishing up a book I've worked on for 30 years, wow, called Beyond the Stoics, because I hope to bring people some of this forgotten source, forgotten treasures, at least in modern business life, in modern corporate life, in modern political life, even in people's personal lives. There's a reading of the Tao Te Ching. There's a reading of Analects of Confucius. There's a reading of Cicero. That Cicero gets some attention these days because of what he said about Stoicism, but he doesn't get much attention in his own right. There's some stuff from a medieval mystic in the Muslim world, Hadrat Ali. There's a Spanish Jesuit, Baltazar Gracian. There's a billionaire Buddhist monk in Japan who must be 100 years old that nobody's ever heard of. And I'm digging into all these treasures of the past and present that I think are neglected, because we need their ideas now. So thanks for asking that. Just like the Stoics were neglected a few years ago, there are a lot of other neglected treasure troves out there. And if I can help people to discover some of them, I'll be feeling like I'm doing something useful.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. And I think, you know, your books are a perfect example of that goal. And Aristotle Running General Motors, as well as The Everyday Patriot. So I'll put links to those below for anybody who is ready to enjoy some more wealth of ancient wisdom.
Thank you so much. This is so much fun to talk like this. I mean, we couldn't have had conversations like this 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. It's a wonderful time to be alive when there's not just such a great need for ancient wisdom, but there's such a great interest in ancient wisdom. And when those two things come together, it makes me very hopeful.
Perfectly said. Thank you for listening to Classical Wisdom Speaks, a podcast dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.